Bevor es losgeht mit dieser Episode, noch ein Hinweis zum nächsten AHA-Festival. Es findet ja schon bald statt. Am 24. und 25. Januar im Südpol in Luzern. Das ganze Programm ist ab jetzt online. Ihr findet es auf unserer Website aha-festival.ch, aber auch hier in den Shownotes. Auch den Ticketlink findet ihr dort. Wer noch ein Weihnachtsgeschenk sucht, über AHA-Tickets freut sich wohl jeder, oder? Dieses Jahr gibt's Vorträge zu Extremismus, zu Popmusik, zu KI und zur USA, um die Sprache der Tiere oder auch um den Tod. Es würde uns sehr freuen, auch unsere Podcast-HörerInnen live im Publikum zu haben. Wir sehen uns. Aber jetzt erstmal viel Spaß mit dieser Lecture.
All expected goals is a way of putting a number on that sentiment. It's the number of chances and the quality of chances that your team had.
How much data is there being measured in a single game?
Millions of data points. And every action is a data point, an event, and that can be tracked. The owners, particularly the American owners, tend to come from finance. And the, you know, the world they understand runs on numbers. I think to them, the idea that this chaotic thing can be quantified is really appealing. But there is a ceiling on what they can achieve because the big clubs, even if they're not quite as smart, are trying to be smart. So you get this hierarchy that is reinforced by data instead of overturned by it.
Was ihr gleich hört, ist ein Gespräch zwischen dem Chef-Fußball-Korrespondent der New York Times, Rory Smith, und Raphael Albisser, Journalist der Wochenzeitung. Der Fußballexperte Rory Smith befasste sich in seinem Buch Expected Goals mit der Frage der Berechenbarkeit des Fußballspiels. Im AHA-Talk beantworten Smith und Albisser die Frage, ob sich guter Fußball berechnen lässt. Viel Spaß mit der Audioversion dieses AHA-Talks.
Thank you very much. Es geht jetzt halt auf Englisch weiter. Ich hoffe, das ist für alle okay. I just said that we're going to continue in English.
I understood all okay. Yeah.
Just a few more words. You don't work from New York. You actually live in Europe. You live in Britain. In Yorkshire, actually the birthplace of club football.
Like old York is essentially where I live, yeah.
Ah, that's amazing. And it's not, you have written a couple of books. The Expected Goals is just the most recent one.
Yeah, I wrote a book. I'm really sorry. I will try and speak clearly. It doesn't come naturally to me. I wrote a book, nine years ago about English coaches abroad, including Swiss legend Roy Hodgson. And then Expected Goals a couple of years ago. Yeah.
Well, it's such a pleasure to have you here. And I would like, we're going to talk about football a lot and about data in football. And I was wondering how many of you in the audience would consider themselves like some sort of football experts or nerds? Hands up. Oh, so we have a couple of them here. Now, who of you doesn't really have any idea of football? So, okay, that's amazing, isn't it?
My wife has put her hand up.
So great to have you here. I mean, it must be not the first time that you hear your husband talk about football.
Sadly not, no.
Well, so this should be, we should remember always that not a lot of nerds are here. And that's also a good thing. I'm not a football nerd as well. I'm not much of a... of an expert. I'm a fan of FC Luzern, so these 90 minutes per week, this is my football life, so this is where we're starting. So my first question would be, what is the best football game you ever saw?
So I am a football nerd, and I'm a Liverpool fan. So emotionally, the answer is either the Champions League final in 2005, when Liverpool were 3-0 down at half-time, came back to win on penalties, or the night that Liverpool beat Barcelona 4-0. On a personal level, they are the high points of my football life. But only one game has ever given me like quite a deep existential crisis. And that was the World Cup final.
Is that a good thing?
I think we should all have the occasional existential crisis. I think that's important. So the World Cup final in Qatar in 2022, and Rafi told me that it was not a tournament he felt especially comfortable with, which was, I think, a sentiment that a lot of people had. I certainly found it a difficult and exhausting experience reporting it, being in Doha for a month. I think if I went back to Doha now, I'm certain that the room I stayed in, no one has slept in since. I think I left an iPhone charger there. I'm pretty sure I could go and get it. And the whole place was this, I don't know, this might be pushing it, the phrase uncanny valley.
Yep.
To describe robotics and stuff.
Like so, the gap between where something feels natural and something is perfectly imitated.
So you see it with robots that look too human. It's weird. It's unsettling for us. Doha exists in an uncanny valley. It's like a real city, but it's not a real city. It's this place that has been built from a dream and just on piles of money. And overnight, it's kind of been transformed in 20 years. And for a month reporting on it, you were really conscious of all the ways in which it felt like a World Cup. So you had lots of Argentinian fans and Colombian fans and colour and noise and genuine like emotion from real people, but in this really fake place. And there were loads of examples of it. There's a bit where there's just a big shark hanging from the sky. No one explained it.
A shark.
There was just a shark in the sky. And you're like, yeah, there's the shark. And then there was the weirdest thing was that in the streets of one of the areas they'd built, there was just music, and you were like, you didn't know where it was coming from. Just these people singing, hiya, hiya. And you were like, where are the, you couldn't see the speakers. It was like there were ghosts. It was really scary. And after a month, like, World Cups are hard, it's fun, but they're hard work. And you have a month of really, like, going to bed at 4 o'clock, 5 o'clock in the morning after coming back from games. And there's all this singing. You don't know where it's coming from. So you're sleep deprived and you're tired. And then at the end of it, you have the greatest football match of all time.
Allow me to ask, where did the sound come from? Did you find
out? I have no idea.
Point?
I don't know. It was just in the Qataris had developed like a system to get it straight into your brain. I don't know. And so at the end, by the time you reach any World Cup final, you're kind of mentally shot. You're done. You want to go home, and you miss your kids. You miss your wife. You want to be at home. And then you get Argentina, France, and after half an hour, Argentina are 2-0 up, and you think, great, I love Argentina, love Messi. This is how it should end. And then Kylian Mbappe insists on scoring goals, and you think, oh, am I allowed to swear? Yeah. So you kind of think,
please do.
Like, the last thing a journalist wants is fucking extra time, because you have a deadline and you're tired and you don't want to change what you've written because obviously it's brilliant. And then Mbappe scores twice. And between his second goal and the winning penalty, I think that is the best football can be. The quality of the play, the stakes of it was the World Cup. It was extra time in the World Cup final. The end of Messi's arc to be the greatest player of all time. The fact that I didn't realise for months, so I don't know, some of you may have ignored that game or that tournament for ethical reasons, and that's a valid decision. But the last minute of injury time in extra time, Randall Colomwani, the French striker, goes through on goal. And Emi Martinez, the Argentine goalkeeper, saves, does this like star shape and saves. And then Argentina goes to the other end of the field. And I think Lautaro Martinez misses a header. He should score, misses a header. And I didn't realise until like 3 months later when my son made me watch the final again. My son was obsessed with that tournament. That it was the same move. The ball didn't go out of play. So France could have won the World Cup. Argentina could have won the World Cup. And I got back and you're really tired and you kind of check out mentally from football for a few weeks. And after I started reporting on it again, I compared everything to the emotional resonance of that game. And I was like, why are you people bothering? Like, this thing is over. You've done it. Like, you have completed this whole experience. Let's just stop. Argentina won. That's the end of football. Let's just leave it. And it genuinely sounds like a joke. It really isn't. It took me, I think, a year before I was watching like a Liverpool game and thinking, stop being so shit. Like, just be better. Like, you get that anger as a fan. And you're
no,
like,
I
okay,
know why.
I'm back, right? Okay, this man I don't know, who is amazing at this sport, is annoying me by not being good enough. Pass the ball to Mo Salah like you should, like I would if I was in your position. And at that point, I thought, okay, maybe I've recovered. But for a year, I still think in 50 years' time, when people write books about it, people will identify that game as the peak of football's like morally dubious golden age.
Okay, thank you very much. That's all we have time for tonight. It must have looked very rude of me to take out my phone, but I was checking my app, taking out this game. I'm going to stats here, and I can tell about this game that Argentina has had way more shots on target, had a bit more expected goals, more possession, way more... big chances, more passes completed. Do you have your own superior app with way more data than I have?
Just my eyes, which we all have, I think. And I think what was really interesting about that game and that tournament is that is a really good sample of all the information you now have about football, that you can analyze really accurately what a game looked like. So... expected goals, which is the title of the book, and is the stat that has kind of cut. It's the most advanced metric that has cut through to the mainstream, and you get a lot of resistance to it.
Okay, let's explain. Yeah.
So basically, the sentiment that all football fans have after every game is either we deserve to win, we were lucky not to lose, or we deserve to lose. Very few fans maybe have that one. All expected goals is a way of putting a number on that sentiment. It's the number of chances and the quality of chances that your team had. So if you win a game 3-0, but you only have 3 shots and they are all from really far out, but the opposition have 50 shots and they hit the bar and the goalie saves one and all that, you've got lucky. Expected goals is just a way of quantifying whether the result that you see on the scoreboard is really a fair reflection of the game. And I think that is quite an instinctive thing to any football fan. You kind of understand that sometimes your team is lucky and sometimes it feels lucky and sometimes it feels unlucky. Having a number just means you can kind of track it over the course of a season, or you can say, well, we were precisely this lucky, or as it's most often used for, you can use it to abuse other fans on social media.
Where you said it's like the on top of all the stats, or at the end of the whole process, expected goals come out. But how do we have to imagine these? How much data is there being measured with in a single game?
Millions of data points, and every action is a data point, an event. Like an event datum, I suppose. And that can be tracked. And then the movement of the players can be tracked. And the flight of the ball can be tracked. And the speed at which the ball travels from player A to player B can be measured and tracked. And you can, all of these things count as data points. And there are 22 people on the pitch and they are all generating data constantly. So you have, it may not be multiple millions of data points, but hundreds of thousands and into the millions per game.
And what's the infrastructure behind that? How is this being measured in a, for example, in a small league like Super League in Switzerland?
Well, so what I thought was really interesting in writing the book, the bit where you kind of, so the thing that you always, and you will have this too, do you hate writing introductions to stories?
I hate writing in total.
Yeah. You have this really ambivalent relationship with the act of writing. Yeah. And I can't tell you the number, like the hours that you spend for like a piece that's 1,000 words, just sitting, staring at your screen, thinking, what is the first word of this story? What's the first paragraph? And when you get one, then the rest of it is like 10 minutes, off we go. No one's going to read it anyway. I'm going to go and do something else. And the bit when I knew I had the first, looking back, it's actually, this isn't a great advert, but it's the only bit of the book I really like, is the first chapter, because I worked out that all of this data starts with people. There are people in Laos and in Egypt and in Portugal, and football's very much a capitalist enterprise. It looks for the low wages. Who are
in the your first protagonist is working in Manila in the Philippines.
And his job, and he loves his job, and he is well paid by Filipino standards, is to watch football matches and to click a button. And as soon as anything happens, he logs the event. And that is how we get data. And I think, obviously, I think the talk before was about big data and how it's sold. And obviously, a lot of that is generated by the infernal thing we keep in our pockets. But in football, the data starts with a person. Someone has to record it. It's not yet automated. I'm sure with AI, it will be eventually. But as things stand, it is inputted by humans. And I'd never thought of that. I knew a lot about football data, and I'd spoken to lots and lots of people who worked at this really high level in data. But it had never occurred to me that there would be some, like, I don't know, they're students, like 20, people in their early 20s. It's like a starter job. They call themselves trackers. And their job is to turn football into numbers.
We've talked about expected goals and millions of other data points. Are there like trends? You know, which metric is being emphasized? Big coaches in their philosophies, they're using this right now, and it's very cutting edge.
Yeah, you get them every so often. XG, expected goals, is the first that really kind of came through. So if you go back into the 90s, they were starting to flash up like percentage of possession. Yep. And then what you would get is lots of, it would say like Real Madrid 70%, Juventus 30%, but Juventus would be winning 1-0, and the commentator, certainly in England, maybe not, maybe Switzerland is more progressive, in England the commentator would be like, well, it just goes to show possession's meaningless and therefore all statistics are. And we worked out pretty quickly that actually possession percentage maybe wasn't that important, as there are, as literally every fan knows, lots of different ways to play football. And sometimes you want to have a lot of the ball, and sometimes you don't really care. And your task is basically to control space and where the game is played, and get the ball and get the opposition to play into an area, and then take it off them and go really fast towards the goal. And so they kind of moved on. Like, you have certain like raw data, like first stage data metrics, I think, are quite important. So I think number of shots is a pretty good guide. If you're having loads of shots, then you're at least in the right end of the pitch.
But there's also a switch between you should take shots from the distance.
Yeah, exactly.
In order to get corners, which has also been debated if they're even useful at all.
Yeah, so corners are not useful, but I think the number of corners you have is a really good guide to kind of the balance of play. This is the wrong place to do this, but in rugby, which is a British sport, there's a metric called territory, and that's basically a measure of like where is the game being played, which matters a lot in rugby. I don't know why, I don't really understand rugby. But anyways, corners is actually quite a good cipher for territory, because if one team has like 15 corners, the chances are they won't score from any of them, but that means that they are playing towards the opposition goal. But then, yeah, like some shots are from outside the box, and those are bad shots. You shouldn't do them, they're naughty. But
when it works, it's the most beautiful goal.
When it works, they're amazing. But most coaches now will say, maybe we'll come on to this, most coaches now will say, maybe don't do that. But because people recognise, okay, not all shots are equal, they then came up with touches inside the opposition box. And as a rule, the number of times you're touching the ball inside the opposition penalty area, again, is a pretty good guide. It's not perfect, but it's a good guide for where the game is being played, and that's important. And then you get the more advanced ones, So there's PPDA, which is passes per defensive action. And that is the limit of my knowledge about it.
Well, let me explain it.
It's something to do with pressing, like the amount of time that the opposition is able to keep the ball before you tackle them. And the other one is field tilt. And again, no idea.
Tilt.
Field tilt. So like, I don't know what tilt is in German, ultimately. And I think the problem that they have is they're too advanced for people to understand. Expected goals, you can just about explain, even to people who resent stats in football, who resent intellectuals in football, who feel that this is all the worst thing it can be, which is American. And like, people do not want anything American in football. Stay away from it.
Here you are, the soccer correspondent.
I know, yeah. I have to say soccer at work. And people always say on Twitter, you can't take him seriously. He calls it soccer. And I think there's loads of reasons not to take me seriously, but that is not one of them. And like, people don't like him. If data had come from Australia, fine. It's American, don't like it. But it needs to be quite intuitive for fans to understand it. And expected goals, I think, on some level, is intuitive. You understand the idea that teams create different amounts of chances, and those chances are of varying quality. Field tilt, no, too complicated, too academic. It is ultimately only football. Maybe we don't need that. If it doesn't express something that you organically understand, I think you can't convince fans of it. And if you can't convince fans of it, you definitely can't convince players.
Well, exactly. That's what I mean. Big data. We've talked about what we're doing, checking on a game, checking expected goals and possession, whatever. But also, who else is driving the whole development? You know, is it coaches, football managers, or is it investors, or is it players, or is it like media, or also bookmakers, betting agencies?
Yeah. So the bookmakers are really important. That is where a lot of the knowledge comes from. And actually, two of the most like data-driven clubs in England, Brighton and Brentford, their owners they made their money in gambling. They're professional gamblers. That's really that the role of bookmakers is really important, or the betting industry. I think a lot of it is definitely not the players. The owners, particularly the American owners, tend to come from finance, and the world they understand runs on numbers. They have made their faintly obscene fortunes in industries where the more knowledge you have, the more money you can make. And you know, it's important to be at 1/500th of a second ahead of your rival on the trade. You have to have that information. So I think to them, the idea that this chaotic thing can be quantified is really appealing. Agents have been quite important.
The ones who Spielervermittler.
Yeah, so they, like, I know that, say, Kevin De Bruyne, the Belgian midfielder at Manchester City, when he signed a contract a couple of years ago, his agent produced like a data-driven document to say, this is how much you should be paying him, because this is how we can quantify his contribution to your success. So for the agents, having that, well, if your player is good, having that information is worthwhile. If your player is not that good, you maybe want to leave that out of the negotiations. So that's been one factor. I think the owners are a big one. The media is really important. That I would say that as a journalist. Obviously, the media is really important. But I think that there was, at the turn of the millennium, like, there was an acceptance that football had an appeal to a broader audience. Events like this did not happen in the 1990s. There was no kind of, like, an ideas festival would not have a football section. But I think as football became this, like, worldwide cultural phenomenon, there was a broader audience interested in it, who wanted to understand it in different ways, who wanted to think about it philosophically or culturally or whatever it might be, however you came to it, or whatever drew you to football. And football does explain the world in a way that few things do. And part of that was was numerical. People wanted to read it as not as an algorithm necessarily, but like they wanted to have that insight into its mechanics, maybe. And tied to that, and these are two things that I think are really important, and it's a pet subject, computer games. So if anyone's played FIFA or Football Manager or equivalent, you are used to seeing players boiled down to numbers. That is how you play that game. It's just, you know, a lot of men, as teenagers or in their early 20s, will spend a lot of their time essentially doing spreadsheets. That is what they're doing. They're just playing with a spreadsheet. Give them Excel, let them have a nice time. And that, I think, broke a lot of barriers. And the other big one is fantasy football, which did the same thing. Like, you know that a player's performance has a value. And once you've broke, they're like the gateway drugs. Once you've broken that barrier to saying football can be quantified, there's a follow-up question, which is, okay, how much of it can we quantify? And I think that drove a lot of the interest in it and a lot of the innovation.
I think in Switzerland, it came up around like 2015. I found newspaper articles on Midtjylland FC, which is a mediocre club in Denmark, and they really decided to go full in on we're letting data decide everything within the club. But before that, it was presented as something new. And when reading your book, we realized that early attempts to, you know, quantify the game go back to the 1950s, actually. So why didn't it catch up earlier?
Well, partly because the guy doing it, the guy in the 1950s, there was this wing commander in the RAF called Charles Reap, who, for reasons that aren't entirely clear, decided to start going to football matches wearing a miner's helmet with a lamp on the front, with a notebook. This is nerdy. No one's a nerd compared to Charles Reap is the nerd. He's like the nerd.
Where did he do that?
Why?
Where did he do that?
Like Swindon. I can list a variety of small English towns that probably are not that familiar. But like football league clubs, and he'd go with a pencil and a notebook and a miner's lamp, and people must have thought he was really weird. And he'd note down all the actions, like pass, cross, tackle, cross. And he had columns, and he was just doing it for, again, men just love playing with spreadsheets. It just is the thing that the patriarchy won't tell you. But his conclusions were basically what you get at the first reading of the statistics. So Reap concluded that most goals came after moves of, I think, five passes or fewer. So his conclusion was the best way to play is in the air and direct. Like, you don't need all this foreign, like, passing around. It's what Italians and Frenchmen do. Like, don't. We're English. The proper way to play is up there. It should be a test of your manly virtue. And obviously that was wrong. It was
kick and rush.
Kick and rush. So he was credited, and he resented it, but credited with not inventing kick and rush. I think the English have been playing kick and rush for a long time, but like validating that idea. And obviously he was right to an extent. Most goals do come after short moves, but it's not because, like, if you start with a goalkeeper and kick it really far forward, you're more likely to score. It's because you're more likely to score if you win the ball back close to the opposition box. And we know that now. But Reap was... I feel kind of sorry for Reap. I think that you need those individuals who make the first steps. All progress to me is incremental. You need those people to make the first steps, or you never really get anywhere. And then you went through this kick and rush period where data was seen as a scientific way of ruining the game. Football is the beautiful game. It should be emotional. It should kind of make something, should spark something in your soul. And this felt cold and academic and calculated and also really ugly. And then basically what changes that is technology. And there's this quote from Marc Andreessen, who is the founder of Andreessen Horowitz, who are one of the Silicon Valley angel investors. He invests a lot of money and makes a lot of money off Roblox, the thing that is ruining children. But he said he came up in the 1990s, before the first dot-com boom. he came up with a cloud computing thing. Again, no further questions. And it was a really good idea, but no one needed it at that point. No one needed all this like massive computing power to store things. And so he sold the company to HP, and then it went bust. And then like 5 years later, when the internet was more advanced, Amazon launched Amazon Web Services, which is its cloud computing business, and makes more money than all of us buying loads of stuff off Amazon. Like Amazon Web Services is massive. And if Andreessen had been 5 years later, he would have been Amazon Web Services, but he wasn't. So he took that to mean that being early is the same as being wrong. And I think in technology that's true, and I think in football it's true. So when they first started using technology to try and take the data from football matches, it was in Leeds actually, in Yorkshire, Crucible of Civilization. And they had like a stack of 8 VCRs, and I don't know if there's anybody under the age of 30 in the audience, but a VCR was a piece of technology that we had in the before times. And they had to stack them on top of each other and like play the game, pause one to capture the moment, then play the next one to capture that. And then it was a really like long, sort of all night to do one game. You can't have like a data revolution if that's what you're stuck with. So the thing that changed, in fact, and the other thing I remember that Opta, who are one of the big data companies now, a friend of mine works for them, and he said that when they first, they were basically a dot-com boom company. And they had this office in a really fancy bit of London near the Bank of England, so really trendy, like really expensive office space, even by Swiss standards. And he said that they had one computer connected to the internet, one. And if they wanted to check something, they all had to sort of wait in line. He said it was like villagers queuing up at a well. And I think that quote's always stuck with me. But the world was not ready for this. The infrastructure didn't exist to do data properly. And the thing that changed it was the DVD. And again, to people who are under the age of 30, before you could stream everything, you had to buy these little discs with movies on them. And so once you had DVDs, you could record a game, you could laser it to DVD, and then you could watch the DVD and pause, play. It became much easier. And that was what enabled the initial rush of data, which was all very basic. It was percentage of possession. It was passes made. It was shots taken. That's what enabled that first rush to come, that you could watch a football match on DVD. And now you speak to data people now and they're like, oh my God, they used to think shots was important. But of course we thought it was important. You couldn't do anything else because you were still stopping a DVD. And none of this stuff can happen if the technology doesn't exist. So there was always a lot of criticism for football being resistant to data in a way that like American sports weren't. But at least part of it was just because, like, what did you want us to do? Like sit and watch with a miner's lamp on our helmets and write down 1, 2... doesn't work. That's not a mass system. So that writing the book really taught me that. It's actually something that I now have adopted into my personal philosophy. That, yeah, we're all dependent on the technology that's around us. It's not, you can't just make leaps. If you make leaps, but you can't actually do them, what's the point? You have to kind of work with what you've got, and that's what happened with data.
I think your book is basically a collection of these intertwined pioneers of data and football. All of them struggling actually to get it to break through the whole technology, and one of the crucial stories, I guess, that popularized the idea must have been Moneyball. The film was in 2011, famously with Brad Pitt and Jonah Hill, and the great Philip Seymour Hoffman also played. But it was actually based on a book that came out in 2003 about baseball revolution that was said to have happened in Auckland. And the subtitle of the book was Moneyball, The Art of Winning an Unfair Game. So it was like you could beat the system by applying data analysis. 20 years later, this sounds pretty ironic because all of the big clubs, they invest millions and millions in their data teams. So data is not a way to beat the system anymore. Or can it still be?
It's a real shame because So I think there's two things that are really significant about Moneyball. One is it came out in 2003, like you say. Football took no notice. Football does not read books as an industry. It cannot be described as literary. But when Brad Pitt's in a film, let me tell you, football is all over. I saw Moneyball in London with, I think Opta did a screening of it, and it was all these kind of scouts and agents and people, executives from clubs. Because once there was a film, you can take it seriously. This idea matters. Someone's made a film
with Brad Pitt.
And Brad Pitt's in it. If it had been more art house, they'd have been like, no, this isn't for us. But the other is that the Oakland A's in Moneyball don't win anything. I think they win their division, but just the way American sports work, that doesn't really mean anything. So they then go into the playoffs and they lose in the playoffs. But America has, for all its faults, has, I think, a much healthier attitude to sport than we do. So Americans are capable of thinking that team did not win at the end of the season, but they have done something worthwhile. Like they have outperformed where they should have been. Whereas in football particularly, if you don't have a trophy, you don't really count. Like you can be as... My weekend in Lucerne was interrupted yesterday by Jurgen Klopp resigning as Liverpool manager, which was very upsetting for me. But in the thing I had to write, I had to say, like, I mean, Klopp has won a Premier League, a Champions League, a Club World Cup, an FA Cup, a League Cup, a Super Cup. And I had to say, you know, some people say that's not enough. And you're like, what do you mean? That's every trophy available. But football is very kind of dog-eat-dog, Darwinian, winner-takes-all. So the two things that I think were really important for data in football, one is that Liverpool started using it and winning stuff. Liverpool is not the most data-driven team in Europe. That's Brentford and Brighton, and maybe Toulouse. But Liverpool were the biggest team to take it seriously, and they had the trophies to show for it. The downside of that is that Liverpool kind of said to all of the other big teams, you guys should be doing this. Because what the moral of Moneyball is that the Oakland A's, who are this like hopeless, scrappy little team in a backwater who never win any games, they can use that to suddenly compete, if not to win. Liverpool showed, actually, you need to do this if you're going to win. So now, obviously, Liverpool have a data department. Barcelona have a data department. Real Madrid, because they are so big, don't need a data department. What can you tell Real Madrid? What can mere numbers tell Real Madrid?
You can measure football, but you cannot measure a ballet.
Exactly. The only statistic that matters is 14 European Cups. That's Real Madrid's the end of their interest in numbers. But pretty much every team now has a data department, and they, some of them do it well, some of them don't, but they're all trying. And that does support the hierarchy that already exists, I guess. So Brighton do some amazing stuff in terms of recruitment. Like Brighton find players in countries that don't exist. They have this sort of apparent production line of, so Brighton signed an Ecuadorian kid like 3 years ago, and now everyone's got an Ecuadorian. And you're like, was Ecuador always amazing at football and we just didn't notice? Or, like, I think, yeah, Chelsea signed an Ecuadorian 9-year-old, which sounds a lot. When you say it out loud, it sounds really bad. But, a 16-year-old kid from Ecuador, they're not even allowed to sign him because he's under 18, so it's people trafficking. Essentially, that's what it is. You're transporting teenagers across borders. That's what you're doing. You might be paying for the privilege, but I'm not sure how that makes it better. But all of a sudden, everyone has to have an Ecuadorian. And Brighton started that. Brighton were like, what about Ecuador? And they have done some amazing stuff, but there is a ceiling on what they can achieve because the big clubs, even if they're not quite as smart, are trying to be smart. So you get this hierarchy that is reinforced by data instead of overturned by it. But I do this, I'm quite a sunny, naive person. So I think that there is a way in which data will start to, or should, if it's used correctly, is a way that you can help narrow the gap a little bit. Because ultimately, you can only put 11 players on the field. You can't, you know, you can be owned by a state, but you can't play everyone in that state. You have to have only 11 players. And they are human and they get injured and they make mistakes and stuff. So I do think data can reduce the gaps a little bit. And funny enough, I think in the Premier League this season, we're seeing that slightly, that the games are closer than normal, that the gap between the giants and everybody else is maybe a little bit smaller than you'd expect. And I think part of that, not all of it, part of that is to do with the fact that they all have so much information about potential signings. They have so much information about each other. They have an understanding of what that information should be telling them, which is really important. That maybe is an encouraging sign for the future.
I think we don't have much time left, 5 minutes. But I want to get back to the beginning, because the World Cup final of 22, best game ever. Has it been the best game ever because of big data in football, or even though there is big data in football? Can it, when you measure it, is it also the best game
in
football?
If you measure it, no, because there's certain things you can't measure the stakes or the drama or the fact that we were all weirded out by the music coming from the streets. I think what made that game so good was that neither team knew that much about the opposition. So for an average game in the Premier League or Serie A or even the Swiss Super League,
of course,
they will, FC Lucerne, your beloved FC Lucerne, will have basically too much information about Basel. And the information will be that Basel are not as good as they used to be, and that will make FC Lucerne very happy. But they will know the patterns of play. They will know the moves that they want to make. They'll know where they take all their shots from. They will know that they do this on the left wing and this on the right wing. They will have this whole set. They'll know exactly who they mark and how they mark them at corners. And that's because they have this season and last season, the season before, and all of that data is coming to them. And if Lucerne have decent analysts, they will be able to go to the coaching staff at the start of the week and say, okay, you need to do this, this and this, or not you need to do this. You concentrate on this. Like, Basel are good at corners. They are good at counter-attacking. They are good at whatever it might be. And the coaches at FC Lucerne will say, okay, we'll change the training sessions and we'll do this. And that should, in theory, mean that whichever team uses the information best wins. Doesn't always happen, obviously. Everyone's human. Sometimes the team with the better players wins. As a general rule, the team with the better players will win a football match. But international football's different. So we've been waiting for a long time for the World Cup to become less appealing, because the Champions League's so important and it's got that theme song, and you hear the theme song and you think that this means a lot.
But it doesn't show in free TV anymore, so.
Well, no, that's a massive, that to be fair is a really important point. If people can't watch it, then football's obsessed with, oh, young people don't watch football anymore. And you think, well, make it free, they might. But in international football, the sample is so much smaller. So you don't know that much about your opposition, comparatively. You also can't change your squad. I used this example to Rafi yesterday, he got really upset. So if Switzerland's best central defender is Philippe Senderos, Switzerland can't go and sign a better one. It just has to deal with the fact that its best central defender is Philippe Senderos. And Rafi made the point, and it's fair, that Philippe Senderos was, by most standards, a really good central defender. So I'm sorry.
There were that many Premier League players in Switzerland back then.
Yeah, that's so fine. Yeah.
What do I know?
But if he's like the best, if that you're kind of stuck with it, or if you don't have a left back, then you just have to play the quite crap left back that you've got and hope that it doesn't really expose you. And that makes international football kind of random. It's a little bit more arbitrary. It's a little bit more dependent on individual quality or on who makes a mistake or who has the game of their lives. And that's more entertaining, ultimately. And to me, there's always been a tension in the middle of... There's a tension in the middle of every professional sport, which is that the people on the pitch and the people who work with them, their job is to win. That's all they care about. They're not interested in anything else. They are paid to win. But as fans, we kind of expect it to be entertaining. And that's a weird thing to judge, because you might... I have a friend who... this is probably not the same. I don't know if it's the same in Switzerland. So on the weather forecast in Britain, if it's not going to be good weather, which is 10 to 11 months of the year, the weather forecaster will say, I'm very sorry, it's going to rain. And my friend says, well, hang on, what? I like it when it rains. Why are you sorry? Some people like the rain. That's fine. I don't, but some people do. And it's the same with football. So I think playing football in the air is ugly, but some people like it, and that's fine. So there's lots of ways of being entertained by football, but we kind of think it should be entertaining. But I'm not sure that acquiring as much information as possible about the opposition, that knowing everything that could feasibly happen, that having all the data you have available is conducive to being entertaining. I think you need a little bit of randomness, a little bit of inspiration for it to be truly entertaining. And that to me, I think, is a central, it sounds like too big a thing to say, but like, I think that is a central issue for football, that you have this thing that is a massive part of the global entertainment complex, but the people who are doing it are doing everything they can to make it as unentertaining as possible. And I'm not quite sure how you square that. Maybe it doesn't matter. Maybe as an audience, we change with the product in front of us, and that's the way we interact with it. I think increasingly what will happen is football will basically just be a big documentary. And like Drive to Survive or Welcome to Wrexham, and we'll just watch it through that. We'll watch it like a year, on a year's delay, once they've had time to put the music on. But I think it's really important. It's really important. It's really interesting, and I don't have an answer for it. But if you know what a player is going to do, you can tell the defender how to stop that player. But what the people in the stands want to see is the player doing the thing. So how do you balance up the impulse to win that the people involved have and the impulse to be entertained that we all have?
Yeah, it's like when the player has the ball 30 meters from the goal and everyone's screaming at him, shoot.
Everyone except his coach, who's saying, don't shoot, because that's a low percentage chance. The XG on that chance is really small. Pass the ball out to the wing. Mm. That's what the coach wants you to do, which is why you see fewer long-range goals. But there's nothing better than seeing a long-range goal.
Is that so? I wasn't sure what you said before. Do you really like long-range goals?
Yeah, there's something like I want to pretend I'm more sophisticated and that actually what I like is an intricate passing move. But when someone kicks a football really hard, it is amazing.
Okay. That's 45 minutes. We still have a question to answer and I'm not sure what the answer is going to be. Can good football be calculated? We don't have time for a long answer.
It can be measured to an extent, but you can't capture it. You can't capture that, the thing that is not popular because it's football's not the biggest global cultural phenomenon there has ever been, apart from like religion. But
what's the difference?
Like there are people in the remotest villages in China who know who Cristiano Ronaldo is, which is very upsetting for all involved, but ultimately is true. And like it is this, like the size of football now is crazy. And part of it is because you can't really explain everything. And I think it would be a shame if you could explain absolutely all of it.
Thank you very much for listening to us trying to do so anyways. Well, thank you so much, Roy, for visiting us. It's been a real pleasure. Thank you so much to AHA Festival. I plan to take one or two questions, but I'm very sorry we don't have time for that. But I think you're going to be...
Sorry. It's my fault.
You're going to be around here, so if anyone has really pressing questions, just don't hesitate to approach him. And I wish you, great AHA Festival, whatever is left of it. Bye, good evening.
Danke, dass du diese Podcast-Episode gehört hast. Ich hoffe, sie hat dir gefallen und du konntest etwas Neues erfahren und lernen. Und wenn du schon mal da bist, lass uns doch eine Bewertung oder ein paar Sternchen da. Das würde uns sehr helfen. Und wenn du mehr Vorträge vom AHA Festival hören willst, abonniere diesen Podcast und folge uns auf Instagram und Facebook. Auch über Feedback freuen wir uns sehr. Schreib uns eine Mail an am@aha-festival.ch. AHA, ein Podcast für Wissen, ist eine Zusammenarbeit von Christoph Fellmann und mir, Anna Matijašević. Mitproduziert und komponiert hat Nikola Miloš Mišić.